substantially applies in Egypt. Osiris constitutes the old state, once great but dangerously anachronistic. Horus partakes of the essence of tradition, he is the son of his father, but is vivified by an infusion of new information. His mother, after all, is the positive aspect of the unknown. As an updated version of his father, he is capable of dealing with the problems of the present, that is, with the emergent evil represented by his uncle. Victorious over his uncle, he is nonetheless incomplete, as his youthful spirit lacks the wisdom of the past. So, he journeys into the unknown where his father rests, lifeless, that is, uncomprehended, without embodiment or incarnation in action in the present. Horus unites himself with his father and becomes the ideal ruler, the consciousness of present youthful life, conjoined with the wisdom of tradition. The dead Egyptian pharaoh, that is, the ruler whose death preceded the ascension of the current pharaoh, was assimilated to, occupied the same categorical space as, Osiris. That meant he was regarded as equivalent to the spirit that founded the state, the archetypal creator god or legendary ancestor whose courageous actions had cosmogonic significance. The current ruler, who depended for much of his power on the traditions of his predecessors, modified when necessary, was regarded as equivalent to Horus and to Re, the sun god. The ruling pharaoh was therefore the power that generated order from chaos, as Re, and the power that rejuvenated order once it had degenerated into unthinking authoritarianism or too rigid and blind tradition. Furthermore, however, he was the rejuvenated Osiris, who was the dead pharaoh, so he was tradition given sight. The sophistication of this idea of reputable leadership, creative power, regenerative power, and revivified tradition can hardly be regarded as anything but remarkable. It is also of overwhelming historical interest and modern relevance that the Egyptians increasingly came to regard Osiris Horus as an exemplar not just of the pharaoh, but of every individual in the kingdom. Iliada states with regard to later Egyptian burial practice. The texts formerly inscribed on the walls of the hidden chambers in the pyramids erected for the pharaohs are now reproduced inside the coffins of the nobility and even of totally unprivileged people. Osiris becomes the model for all those who hope to conquer death. A coffin text proclaims, "Thou art now the son of a king, a prince, as long as thy heart, i.e. spirit, shall be with thee." Following Osiris's example, and with his help, the dead are able to transform themselves into souls, that is, into perfectly integrated and hence indestructible spiritual beings. Murdered and dismembered, Osiris was reconstituted by Isis and reanimated by Horus. In this way, he inaugurated a new mode of existence. From a powerless shade, he became a person who knows, a duly initiated spiritual being. This development might also be regarded as an illustration of the increasing psychologization, abstraction, and internalization of religious ideation. In the earliest stages of representation, deities are viewed as pluralistic and as individualistic and fractious members of a supra-celestial, that is, transpersonal and immortal, community. Later, they are integrated into a hierarchy as the culture becomes more integrated, more sure about relative valuation and moral virtue, and a single god with a multitude of related features comes to dominate. Development of monotheism thus parallels intrapsychic and intercultural moral integration. As the average citizen identifies more and more clearly with this monotheistic integrated pattern, its external nature as an attribute of the gods recedes. it becomes more clearly an attribute of the individual human being, and more like what we would conceive of as a psychological trait. The god's subjective aspect, his or her intrapsychic quality, becomes more evident, at least to the most sophisticated of intuitions, and the possibility of personal relationship with the deity emerges as a prospect at the conceptual level of analysis. The process is just beginning in abstraction in Mesopotamia and Egypt. The ancient Israelites bring it most clearly to fruition with potent and lasting effect. It does not seem unreasonable to regard this development as a precursor to the Christian Revolution, which granted every individual the status of Son of God, and as implicitly akin to our modern notion of the intrinsic human right. The Egyptian pharaoh, like the Mesopotamian king, served as material incarnation of the process that separates order from chaos. Simultaneously, the pharaoh king literally embodied the state. Finally, the pharaoh king was the rejuvenator of his own father. The ideal pharaoh king was therefore the exploratory process that gave rise to the state. The state itself, and the revivifying exploratory process that updated the state when it was in danger of too conservative ossification. This massively complex and sophisticated conceptualization is given added breadth and depth by consideration of its psychological element. The state is not merely cultural. It is also spiritual. As custom and tradition is established, it is inculcated into each individual and becomes part of their intrapsychic structure. The state is therefore personality and social organization simultaneously. Personality and social order conjoined in the effort to keep the terror of chaos at bay, or, better still, united in the effort to make something positively useful of it. This means that the hero king who establishes, embodies, and updates the social world is also the same force that establishes, embodies, and updates the intrapsychic world, the personality, and that one act of update cannot necessarily or reasonably be distinguished from the other. In improving the world, the hero improves himself. In improving himself, he sets an example for the world. Initially, the personality of state was in fact a ritual human model, a hero to observe and imitate, an entity represented in behavioral pattern. Then a story about such ritual models, an entity represented in imagination. And, finally, and only much later, an abstract construction of rules describing the explicit rights and responsibilities of the citizenry, an entity of words, the body of law. This increasingly abstract and detailed construction develops from imitation to abstract representation, and comprises rules and schemas of interpretations useful for maintaining stability of interpersonal interaction. The establishment of these rules and schemas gives determinate meaning to human experience by bringing predictability to all social situations, to all things encountered interpersonally. The same thing might be said from the psychological perspective. It is incorporation of the personality of state, dominated by the figure of the hero, that brings order to the inner community of necessity and desire, to the generative chaos of the soul. The Mesopotamian culture hero slash deity Marduk represents the capacity of the process of exploration to generate the world of experience. The Egyptian gods Horus Osiris represent the extended version of that capacity, which means not only generation of the world from the unknown, but transformation of the pattern of adaptation which constitutes the known when such transformation becomes necessary. Sometimes, adaptation is merely a matter of the adjustment of the means to an end. More rarely, but equally necessarily, adaptation is reconceptualization of what is known unbearable present, desirable future, and means to attain such, because what is known is out of date and therefore deadly. It is the sum of these processes that manifests itself in the Judeo-Christian tradition as the mythic Word of God, and which is embodied in Christ, the Christian culture hero. This is the force that generates subject and object from the primordial chaos, and, therefore, which predates the existence of both. The force that engenders the tradition that makes vulnerable existence possible in the face of constant mortal threat, and the force that updates protective tradition when it has become untenable and tyrannical on account of its age. The Sumerian and Egyptian myths portray ideas of exceeding complexity in ritual, drama, and imagistic form. This form is not purposeful mystification, but the manner in which ideas emerge before they are sufficiently developed to be explicitly comprehensible. We acted out and provisionally formulated complete, impressionistic models of the world of experience, which was the world we always had to understand, long before the contents of such models could be understood in the way we currently conceive of understanding. Brief analysis of the Sumerian and Egyptian theologies and of the relationship of those theologies to political action shed substantial light on the manner in which many of our most important modern ideas developed, and on what those ideas actually mean. This understanding, derived from two or three specific examples, can be further enhanced through more general discussion. We therefore turn our attention from analysis of complete stories, which have as their advantage a more compelling nature, to detailed description of the mythological characters whose essence and interactions constitute the world. The totality of the world, which includes the significance of experienced things as well as the things themselves, is composed of what has been explored and rendered familiar, what has yet to be encountered and is therefore unpredictable, and the process that mediates between the two. One final element must be additionally considered. The state of being that includes or precedes the division of everything into these three constituent elements. This state might be regarded as the true source of all things, subjects and objects, the single ancestor and final destination of all. The complete mythological world of experience is portrayed schematically in Figure 28, the constituent elements of experience as personality, territory, and process. Our discussion turns first to the diverse nature of representations of the original undifferentiated state, the condition of primordial chaos, and then to a more elaborated description of its children, the divine parents, nature and culture, and the divine son, simultaneously child, primal creator, and eternal adversary. The Dragon of Primordial Chaos. The source of things is the boundless. From whence they arise, thence they must also of necessity return. For they do penance and make compensation to one another for their injustice in the order of time. Anaximander of Miletus. It might seem futile to speculate about the nature of that which existed prior to any experience, or that which has not yet been explored. Futile or not, such speculation has occupied a good portion of man's time as he attempted to understand the mystery of his emergence and of the world he found himself occupying. It seems impossible to determine what it is that was before anything was. Myth attempts that task, despite its impossibility. It does so using the tool of metaphor. The metaphorical statements of myth work because unknown or partially known things inevitably share characteristics of importance with somewhat more thoroughly investigated, comprehended, and familiar things. Two or more objects or situations come to occupy the same mythological or categorical space, therefore, because they share similar form, function, or capacity to induce affect and compel behavior. A mandrake root, for example, has the nature of a man, symbolically speaking, because it has the shape of a man. Mars is a warlike planet because it is red, and red, the color of blood, is associated indelibly with aggression. The metal, Mercury, and the spirit that inhabits it is akin to seawater because both may serve as solvents or agents of transformation. The dark and the animal of the forest are the same because they are both unfamiliar, because they both inhibit ongoing behavior when they make their appearance, because they both cause fear. Metaphor links thing to thing, situation to situation, concentrating on the phenomenological, affective, functional, and motivational features the linked situations share. Through such linkage, what might otherwise remain entirely mysterious can begin to become comprehended. Myths of the origin metaphorically portray the nature of the infinite potential that characterized being prior to the dawn of experience. This general symbolic construction takes many particular forms, each of which might be said to constitute a partial attempt to represent the unrepresentable whole. These particular forms range in nature from the specific and concrete to the general and abstract, and are influenced in their development by the environmental and cultural conditions obtaining at the time of their emergence. The process of metaphorical representation provides a bridge, and an increasingly communicable bridge, between what can be directly explored, experienced, and comprehended, and what remains eternally unknown. Mythic symbols of the chaos of the beginning are imaginative pictures whose purpose is representation of a paradoxical totality, a state, which is already to say something too determinate, self-contained, uniform, and complete, where everything now distinct resides in union, a state where being and non-being, beginning and end, matter and energy, spirit and body, consciousness and unconsciousness, femininity and masculinity, night and day remain compounded prior to the discrimination into the separable elements of experience. In this state, all conceivable pairs of opposites and contradictory forces exist together within the all-encompassing embrace of an omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, and altogether mysterious God. This paradisal precondition, lacking nothing, characterized by absolute completion, exists in contradistinction to the profane world, imperfect and partial, suspended unbearably in time and in space. It surrounds that world completely, like the night surrounds the day, comprising the beginning of things, the fountainhead for everything, and, similarly, the resting place and destination point for all. The seminal psychologist William James turned to poetry in his attempt to conceptualize this place. No verbiage can give it, because the verbiage is other. Incoherent, coherent, same, and it fades, and it's infinite, and it's infinite. Don't you see the difference? Don't you see the identity? Constantly opposites united. The same me telling you to write and not to write. Extreme, extreme, extreme. Something and other than that thing. Intoxication and otherness than intoxication. Every attempt at betterment, every attempt at otherment is a, it fades forever and forever as we move. This state, the totality of all things, might be regarded as the objective world in the absence of the subject, although this conceptualization is too narrow, as primordial chaos also contains that which evolves into the subject when it is differentiated. What might be regarded as the standard objective viewpoint is predicated on the idea that things as they are perceived exist regardless of the perceiver. From a certain perspective, this is true. Things have a nature that appears independent of subjective will and follow their own laws of being and development, despite our wishes. However, the job of determining what a thing is in the absence of the subject is much more difficult than might initially be imagined. It is certainly the case, as we have seen, that the value of an object can shift with shifts in frame of reference. It appears to be true, however, that what an object is and of itself, is also subject to such shift. Any given object, a table, say, exists as a table because it is apprehended only in a very limited and restrained manner. Something is a table at a particular and isolated level of analysis, specified by the nature of the observer. In the absence of this observer, one might ask, what is it that is being apprehended? Is the proper level of analysis and specification subatomic, atomic, or molecular, or all three at once? Should the table be considered an indistinguishable element of the Earth upon which it rests, or of the solar system which contains the Earth, or of the galaxy itself? The same problem obtains from the perspective of temporality. What is now table was once tree, before that Earth, before that rock, before that star. What is now table also has before it an equally complex and lengthy developmental history waiting in front of it. It will be, perhaps, ash, then earth, then, far enough in the future, part of the sun again, when the sun finally re-envelops the earth. The table is what it is only at a very narrow span of spatial and temporal resolution, the span that precisely characterizes our consciousness. So what is the table as an independent object, free, that is, of the restrictions that characterize the evidently limited human viewpoint? What is it that can be conceptualized at all spatial and temporal levels of analysis simultaneously? Does the existence of the thing include its interactions with everything it influences and is influenced by, gravitationally and electromagnetically? Is that thing everything it once was, everything it is, and everything it will be, all at the same time? Where, then, are its borders? How can it be distinguished from other things? And, without such distinction, in what manner can it be said to exist? Question. What is an object, in the absence of a frame of reference? Answer. It is everything conceivable at once. Is something that constitutes the union of all currently discriminable opposites, and something that cannot, therefore, be easily distinguished from nothing. I am not saying that there are no such things as things. That would, of course, be patently absurd. It is also fully apparent that the things we apprehend are rule-governed. The cosmos as we experience it is orderly and rationally comprehensible. What I am claiming is that objective things are in fact the product of an interaction between whatever constitutes our limited consciousness and whatever constitutes the unlimited background that makes up the world in the absence of a subject. This is a stance informed by mythology, in particular by myths of the origin. Archaic myths describing the ultimate origin concern themselves with representation of the source, not of objects in the modern sense, but of subjects and the experience of those subjects, some part of which can be regarded as objects. Such myths typically describe the genesis of the world of experience by relating the existence of a primordial god, portraying the division of this god into the world parents, and detailing the separation of those parents by their own son. This is the division of the hermaphroditic, all-encompassing, self-devouring, and nourishing serpent of chaos into earth/matter and sky/spirit, and the subsequent discrimination of those primordial opposing forces into identifiable aspects of being. The Indo-European myth of Indra and Vritra provides a representative example outlined by Iliada. The central myth of Indra, which is, furthermore, the most important myth in the Rig Veda, narrates his victorious battle against Vritra, the gigantic dragon who held back the waters in the hollow of the mountains. Strengthened by Soma, Indra lays the serpent low with his Vajra, thunderbolt, the weapon forged by Devastator, splits open his head and frees the waters, which pour into the sea like bellowing cows. The battle of a god against an ophidian or marine monster is well known to constitute a widespread mythological theme. We need only remember the struggle between Re and Apophis, between the Sumerian god Ninurta and Asag, Marduk and Tiamat, the Hittite storm god and the serpent Ilu-Yancas, Zeus and Typhon, the Iranian hero Thretona, and the three-headed dragon Ajidahaka. In certain cases, Marduk, Tiamat, for example, the god's victory constitutes the preliminary condition for the cosmogony. In other cases, the stake is the inauguration of a new era or the establishment of a new sovereignty, for example, Zeus, Typhon, or Baal, Yam. In short, it is by the slaying of an ophidian monster, symbol of the virtual, of chaos, but also of the autochthonous, that a new cosmic or institutional situation comes into existence. A characteristic feature, and one common to all these myths, is the fright or a first defeat of the champion. Marduk and Re hesitate before fighting. At the onset, the serpent Ilu-Yancas succeeds in mutilating the god. Typhon succeeds in cutting and carrying off Zeus's tendons. According to the Satapatha Brahmana, Indra, on first seeing Vritra, runs away as far as possible, and the Markandeya Purana describes him as sick with fear and hoping for peace. It would serve no purpose to dwell on the naturalistic interpretations of this myth. The victory over Vritra has been seen either as rain brought on by a thunderstorm, or as the freeing of the mountain waters, or as the triumphs of the sun over the cold that had imprisoned the waters by freezing them. Certainly, naturalistic elements are present, since the myth is multivalent. Indra's victory is equivalent, among other things, to the triumph of life over the sterility and death resulting from the immobilization of the waters by Vritra. But the structure of the myth is cosmogonic. In Rig Veda 133:4, it is said that, by his victory, the god created the sun, the sky, and dawn. According to another hymn, Indra, as soon as he was born, separated the sky from the earth, fixed the celestial vault, and, hurling the Vajra, tore apart Vritra, who was holding the waters captive in the darkness. Now, sky and earth are the parents of the gods. Indra is the youngest and also the last god to be born, because he put an end to the hierogamy, mystical union, of sky and earth. Quote, by his strength he spread out these two worlds, sky and earth, and caused the sun to shine. End quote. After this demiurgic feat, Indra appointed Varuna a cosmocrator and guardian of Urta, which had remained concealed in the world below. There are other types of Indian cosmogonies that explain the creation of the world from a materia prima. This is not the case with the myth we have just summarized, for here a certain type of world already existed. For sky and earth were formed and had engendered the gods. Indra only separated the cosmic parents, and, by hurling the Vajra at Vritra, he put an end to the immobility, or even the virtuality, symbolized by the dragon's mode of being. Indra comes across Vritra, not divided, not awake, plunged in the deepest sleep, stretched out. According to certain traditions, the fashioner of the gods, Devastator, whose role is not clear in the Rig Veda, had built himself a house and created Vritra as a sort of roof, but also as walls for his habitation. Inside this dwelling, encircled by Vritra, sky, earth, and the waters existed. Indra bursts asunder this primordial monad by breaking the resistance and inertia of Vritra. In other words, the world and life could not come to birth except by the slaying of an amorphous being. In countless variants, this myth is quite widespread. The primordial, theriomorphic serpent god is endless potential, is whatever being is prior to the emergence of the capacity for experience. This potential has been represented as the self-devouring dragon, most commonly, because this image, portrayed in figure 29, the Ouroboros, pre-cosmogonic dragon of chaos, aptly symbolizes the union of incommensurate opposites. The Ouroboros is simultaneously representative of two antithetical primordial elements. As a snake, the Ouroboros is a creature of the ground, of matter. As a bird, a winged animal, it is a creature of the air, the sky, spirit. The Ouroboros symbolizes the union of known, associated with spirit, and unknown, associated with matter, explored and unexplored. Symbolizes the juxtaposition of the masculine principles of security, tyranny, and order with the feminine principles of darkness, dissolution, creativity, and chaos. Furthermore, as a snake, the Ouroboros has the capacity to shed its skin, to be reborn. Thus, it also represents the possibility of transformation and stands for the knower who can transform chaos into order and order into chaos. The Ouroboros stands for or comprises everything that is as of yet unencountered prior to its differentiation as a consequence of active exploration and classification. It is the source of all the information that makes up the determinant world of experience and is, simultaneously, the birthplace of the experiencing subject. The Ouroboros is one thing, as everything that has not yet been explored is one thing. It exists everywhere and at all times. It is completely self-contained, completely self-referential. It feeds, fertilizes, and engulfs itself. It unites the beginning and the end, being and becoming, in the endless circle of its existence. It serves as symbol for the ground of reality itself. It is the set of all things that are not yet things, the primal origin and ultimate point of return for every discriminable object and every independent subject. It serves as progenitor of all we know, all that we don't know, and of the spirit that constitutes our capacity to know and not know. It is the mystery that constantly emerges when solutions to old problems cause new problems, is the sea of chaos surrounding man's island of knowledge and the source of that knowledge as well. It is all new experience generated by time, which incessantly works to transform the temporarily predictable once again into the unknown. It has served mankind as the most ubiquitous and potent of primordial gods, as Eric Neumann, Jung's great student, suggests. This is the ancient Egyptian symbol of which it is said, Draco interfecit si ipsum, meritat si ipsum, impregnat si ipsum. It slays, weds, and impregnates itself. It is man and woman begetting and conceiving, devouring and giving birth, active and passive, above and below, at once. As the heavenly serpent, the Ouroboros was known in ancient Babylon. In later times, in the same area, it was often depicted by the Mandaeans. Its origin is ascribed by Macrobius to the Phoenicians. It is the archetype of the All-One, appearing as Leviathan and as Ion, as Oceanus, and also as the primal being that says, I am Alpha and Omega. As the Neph of antiquity, it is the primal snake, the most ancient deity of the prehistoric world. The Ouroboros can be traced in the revelation of St. John and among the Gnostics, as well as among the Roman syncretists. There are pictures of it in the sand paintings of the Navajo Indians and in Giotto. It is found in Egypt, Africa, Mexico, and India, among the gypsies as an amulet, and in the alchemical texts. The Ouroboros is Tiamat, the dragon who inhabits the deep, transformed by Marduk into the world. Apophis, the serpent who nightly devours the sun, and Rahab the Leviathan, slain by Yahweh in the course of the creation of the cosmos. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Canst thou put a hook into his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird? Or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens? Shall the companions make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thine hand upon him. Remember the battle. Do no more. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? Who hath prevented me that I should repay him? Whatsoever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not conceal his parts, nor his power, nor his comely proportion. Who can discover the face of his garment? Or who can come to him with his double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined to one another. They stick together that they cannot be sundered. By his kneesings a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. In his neck remaineth strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. The flakes of his flesh are joined together. They are firm in themselves. They cannot be moved. His heart is as firm as a stone, yea, as hard as a piece of the nether millstone. When he raiseth up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of breakings, they purify themselves. The sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold, the spear, the dart, nor the habergeon. He esteemeth iron as straw, and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. Darts are counted as stubble. He laugheth at the shaking of a spear. Sharp stones are under him. He spreadeth sharp-pointed things upon the mire. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Upon earth there is not his like, who is made without fear. He beholdeth all high things. He is a king over all the children of pride. Job 41:1-34. The Ouroboros is that which exists as pure, unqualified potential, prior to the manifestation of such potential, in the experience of the limited subject. Is the infinite possibility for sudden, dramatic unpredictability that still resides in the most thoroughly explored and familiar of objects, things, other people, ourselves. That unpredictability is not mere material possibility or potential, it is also meaning. The domain of chaos, which is where what to do has not yet been specified, is a place characterized by the presence of potent emotions, discouragement, depression, fear, rootlessness, loss, and disorientation. It is the affective aspect of chaos that constitutes what is most clearly known about chaos. It is darkness, drought, the suspension of norms, and death. It is the terror of the dark of the night, which fills itself with demons of the imagination, yet exerts an uncanny fascination. It is the fire that magically reduces one determinate thing to another. It is the horror and curiosity engendered by the stranger and foreigner. The Ouroboros, the primordial matrix, contains in embryonic form everything that can in principle possibly be experienced and the thing that does the experiencing. The great serpent, the matrix, is therefore consciousness, spirit before it manifests itself, and matter before it is separated from spirit. This great mythological idea finds its echo in certain modern theories of the development of the subject, most particularly among those entitled constructivist. The famous Swiss developmental psychologist Jean Piaget claimed, for example, that the experiencing subject constructs himself in infancy as a consequence of his exploratory activity. He acts and observes himself acting, then imitates the action, forming a primordial representation of himself. Later, formulates a more abstracted model of his own actions. Thus, the subject is created from the information generated in the course of exploratory activity. Contemporaneously, the world comes into being. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces, and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Thou didst cleave the fountain and the flood. Thou driedst up mighty rivers. The day is thine. The night also is thine. Thou hast prepared the light and the sun. Thou hast set all the borders of the earth. Thou hast made summer and winter. Psalm 74:14-17. Actions have consequences. The consequences of actions constitute the world, the familiar world when they are predictable, the world of the unexpected when they are not. The state of the origin has been represented most abstractly as a circle, the most perfect of geometric forms, or as a sphere, without beginning or end, symmetrical across all axes. Plato, in the Timaeus, described the primary source as the round, there at the beginning. In the Orient, the world and its meaning springs from the encircled interplay and union of the light, spiritual, masculine yang and the dark, material, feminine yin. According to the adepts of medieval alchemy, discernible objects of experience and the subjects who experienced them emerged from the round chaos, which was a spherical container of the primordial element. The God of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last, Revelations 22:13, places himself outside of or beyond worldly change and unites the temporal opposites within the great circle of his being. The assimilation of the origin to a circle finds narrative echo in myths describing heaven as the end to which life is or should be devoted, at least from the perspective of the immortal soul. The kingdom of God promised by Christ is in fact re-establishment of paradise, although a paradise characterized by reconciliation of opposing forces and not regressive dissolution into pre-conscious unity. Such re-establishment closes the circle of temporal being. The Ouroboric initial state is the place where all opposite things were, will be, united. The great self-devouring dragon whose division into constituent elements constitutes the precondition for experience itself. This initial state is a place free of problems and has a paradisal aspect in consequence. However, the price that must be paid for Ouroboric paradise is being itself. It is not until the original unity of all things is broken up, until the most primordial of gods is murdered, that existence itself springs into being. The emergence of things, however, brings with it the problem of conflict, a problem that must be solved optimally, without eliminating the fact of existence itself. The Ouroboros is the unified parent of the known, the Great Father, explored territory and the familiar, and of the unknown, the Great Mother, anomalous information and the unpredictable. It might be regarded as well as the single androgynous grandparent of the hero, son of the night and the day, mediator between the known and unknown, whose being constitutes a necessary precondition for the existence of differentiated things, and who can, therefore, also be regarded as a causa prima. The world parents, earth and sky, emerge when the Ouroboric dragon undergoes a first division. Figure 30, the birth of the world parents, presents the birth of the world in schematic form insofar as it has been conceptualized by the mythic imagination. The chaos that constitutes totality divides itself into what has been explored and what has yet to be explored. From the mythic perspective, this division is equivalent to the emergence of the cosmos and, therefore, to creation or Genesis itself. One thing is missing, the fact of the explorer, and the nature of his relationship with what is known and what has yet to be known. With the birth of the explorer, with his construction from the interplay between culture and nature, the entire world comes into being. This emergence of experience is portrayed in Figure 31, the constituent elements of the world in dynamic relationship. The knower is simultaneously child of nature and culture, creator of culture as a consequence of his encounter with nature or the unknown world, and the person for whom the unknown is a reality. It is almost impossible to overestimate the degree to which the world parent's schema of categorization colors, or alternatively has been derived from, fundamental human presumption and activity. The world is explored territory, surrounded by mystery. That mystery is experienced as undifferentiated but oft-menacing chaos. Everything that occupies such chaos is directly perceived, not abstractly conceptualized, as identical to it, is directly perceived as unknown and anxiety-provoking. The foreigner, therefore, the occupant of the habitation of dragons, Isaiah 34:13, is naturally apprehended as an agent of formless chaos. Iliada states, one of the outstanding characteristics of traditional societies is the opposition that they assume between their inhabited world and the unknown and indeterminate space that surrounds it. The former is the world, more precisely our world, the cosmos. Everything outside it is no longer a cosmos, but a sort of other world, a foreign, chaotic space, peopled by ghosts, demons, foreigners, who are assimilated to, undistinguished from, more accurately, the demons and the souls of the dead. Everything outside occupies the same categorical space as the dragon of chaos or the terrible mother. The early Indo-Europeans equated the destruction of enemies in battle to the slaying of Ritra by Indra. The ancient Egyptians regarded the Hyksos, barbarians, as equivalent to Apophis, the serpent who nightly devours the sun. And the archaic Iranians, Zoroastrians, equated the mythic struggle of King Pharaon against a foreign usurper, the dragon Azdahak, with the cosmogonic fight of the hero Thretona against Azidahaka, the primordial serpent of chaos. The enemies of the Old Testament Hebrews also suffer the same fate. They are regarded as equivalent to Rahab or Leviathan, the serpent overcome by Yahweh in his battle to establish the world. Speak and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers, which hath said, my river is mine own, and I have made it for myself. Ezekiel 29:3. Also, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, hath devoured me. He hath crushed me. He hath made me an empty vessel. He hath swallowed me up like a dragon. He hath filled his belly with my delicates. He hath cast me out. Jeremiah 51:34. Iliada continues, "At first sight, this cleavage in space appears to be due to the opposition between an inhabited and organized, hence cosmicized, territory and the unknown space that extends beyond its frontiers. On one side, there is a cosmos, on the other, a chaos. But we shall see that if every inhabited territory is a cosmos, this is precisely because it was first consecrated, because in one way or another it is the work of the gods or is in communication with the world of the gods. The world, that is our world, is a universe within which the sacred has already manifested itself, in which, consequently, the breakthrough from plane to plane has become possible and repeatable. It is not difficult to see why the religious moment implies the cosmogonic moment. The sacred reveals absolute reality and at the same time makes orientation possible. Hence, it founds the world in the sense that it fixes the limits and establishes the order of the world." All this appears very clearly from the Vedic ritual for taking possession of a territory. Possession becomes legally valid through the erection of a fire altar consecrated to Agni. One says that one is installed when one has built a fire altar, and all those who build the fire altar are legally established. By the erection of a fire altar, Agni is made present, and communication with the world of the gods is ensured. The space of the altar becomes a sacred space. But the meaning of the ritual is far more complex, and if we consider all of its ramifications, we shall understand why consecrating a territory is equivalent to making it a cosmos, to cosmicizing it. For in fact, the erection of an altar to Agni is nothing but the reproduction on the microcosmic scale of the creation. The water in which the clay is mixed is assimilated to the primordial water. The clay that forms the base of the altar symbolizes the earth. The lateral walls represent the atmosphere, and so on. And the building of the altar is accompanied by songs that proclaim which cosmic region has just been created. Hence, the erection of a fire altar, which alone validates taking possession of a new territory, is equivalent to a cosmogony. An unknown, foreign, and unoccupied territory, which often means unoccupied by our people, still shares in the fluid and larval modality of chaos. By occupying it, and above all, by settling in it, man symbolically transforms it into a cosmos through a ritual repetition of the cosmogony. What is to become our world must first be created, and every creation has a paradigmatic model, the creation of the universe by the gods. When the Scandinavian colonists took possession of Iceland and cleared it, they regarded the enterprise neither as an original undertaking nor as human and profane work. For them, their labor was only repetition of a primordial act, the transformation of chaos into cosmos by the divine act of creation. When they tilled the desert soil, they were in fact repeating the act of the gods who had organized chaos by giving it a structure, forms, and norms. Whether it is a case of clearing uncultivated ground or of conquering and occupying a territory already inhabited by other human beings, ritual taking possession must always repeat the cosmogony. For in the view of archaic societies, everything that is not our world is not yet a world. A territory can be made ours only by creating it anew, that is, by consecrating it. This religious behavior in respect to unknown lands continued even in the West down to the dawn of modern times, and was reflected recently in the planting of the flag on the moon by the American astronauts. The Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors, discovering and conquering territories, took possession of them in the name of Jesus Christ, the world-creating Logos. A similar form of ritual and ideation dominates processes even as simple as the establishment of a new building. As Iliada points out, in India, before a single stone is laid, the astrologer shows what spot in the foundation is exactly above the head of the snake that supports the world. The mason fashions a little wooden peg from the wood of the Kadira tree, and with a coconut drives the peg into the ground at this particular spot in such a way as to peg the head of the snake securely down. If this snake should ever shake its head really violently, it would shake the world to pieces. A foundation stone is placed above the peg. The cornerstone is thus situated exactly at the center of the world. But the act of foundation at the same time repeats the cosmogonic act, for to secure the snake's head to drive the peg into it is to imitate the primordial gesture of Soma, or of Indra when the latter smote the serpent in his lair when his thunderbolt cut off his head. Order, explored territory, is constructed out of chaos and exists simultaneously in opposition to that chaos, to the new chaos, more accurately, to the unknown now defined in opposition to explored territory. Everything that is not order, that is, not predictable, not usable, is by default, by definition, chaos. The foreigner, whose behaviors cannot be predicted, who is not kin either by blood or by custom, who is not an inhabitant of the cosmos, whose existence and domain has not been sacralized, is equivalent to chaos, and not merely metaphorically equated with chaos. As such, his appearance means threat, as his action patterns and beliefs have the capacity to upset society itself, to dissolve and flood the world, and to reinstitute the dominion of the Ouroboros. The Great Mother, images of the unknown or unexplored territory. The mother of songs, the mother of our whole seed, bore us in the beginning. She is the mother of all races of men and the mother of all tribes. She is the mother of the thunder, the mother of the rivers, the mother of trees and of all kinds of things. She is the mother of songs and dances. She is the mother of the older brother stones. She is the mother of the grain and the mother of all things. She is the mother of the younger brother Frenchmen and of the strangers. She is the mother of the dance paraphernalia and of all temples, and the only mother we have. She is the mother of the animals, the only one, and the mother of the Milky Way. It was the mother herself who began to baptize. She gave us the limestone coca dish. She is the mother of the rain, the only one we have. She alone is the mother of all things, she alone. And the mother has left a memory in all the temples. With her sons, the saviors, she left songs and dances as a reminder. Thus the priests, the fathers, and the older brothers have reported. From Eric Neumann. Representation of culture, the known, is simple, comparatively. It is second-order abstraction, depiction of that which has already been made subject to order. Representation of culture is encapsulation of that to which behavioral adaptation has previously occurred, of those things or situations whose sensory properties, affective implications, and motivational significances have been and are presently specified. Representation of the knower, the human subject, is also depiction of that which is constantly encountered in all interpersonal interactions and in all self-conscious states, is portrayal of those aspects of an infinitely complex set of data which have at least been experienced, if not exhausted. Representation of the unknown, however, appears impossible, a contradiction in terms. How can what has not yet been encountered be comprehended, understood, embodied, faced, or adapted to? But what has not been encountered must be comprehended. The range of our experience continually supersedes the domain of our determinate knowledge. We are, therefore, prone to constant contact with the unknown. It appears every time we make an error. Every time our presumptions are wrong. Every time our behaviors do not